I hope you can all hear me. If you can't and want to, wait. When I needed a neighbour, were you there? When I became an octogenarian, it's a lovely word, isn't it? I'm not quite sure what I expected. But now I'm well into my 90th, my ninth decade, not my 90th. I'm finding that some is good, some things are bad, but from the bad, much good has come. And I'm finding myself reflecting on the past in a way I haven't done before, and appreciating how it's contributed to making my life as good as it is today. I've been reading, as you will have gathered, the biography of Elizabeth Fry. And this has made me realise just how different my life would have been if I had lived in the 19th century. I will argue that the philanthropists of the 19th century were the rich of their day, using their money, position, Christian compassion and skills to help others. But because of them, with our education today, our health and social welfare, we are the rich of today, and with that, carry great responsibility for the future. When trying to appreciate just how recent was the 19th century, I began thinking about my own family. I was told that my great-grandmother could neither read nor write because she'd never been to school. My grandmother, who I remember well, fondly, went to school, but at a penny a week. She was one of a typical large Victorian family, and on leaving school, went into service. Not to Downton Abbey, but she went as a skivvy to one of the rising middle-class families in London. And my mother told me that on my grandmother's monthly afternoon and evening off, she went to the home of a member of the Girls' Friendly Society, who opened their homes to these servant girls, mostly from the country, who had nowhere else to go. One evening, my grandmother, returning to her employer, found that they had done a moonlight flit to escape their debts. And they had left behind, at night, in London, this child who would have been no more than 13, 14 years old, very little older than Eli. As we said with the children, these walls were here during Elizabeth Fry's ministry. 3 years before she died, our predecessors of this dissenting chapel, already very well established in the village, converted this building from a tannery, and by the time of her death, had 25 members and, note, 85 children in the Sabbath school. Many of these would not have been able to read and write because, like my grandmother, they'd never had the opportunity to go to school. The Wheatley Society publication about my high street made me realise just how vibrant a community was here at that time. But however, we need to remember that Wheatley life was still within the social order of the day. much of which by our 21st century standards was very cruel. Earlier, we identified buildings that were here at that time. But we need to remember that there are others now, long gone, such as the workhouse in Wheatley, which after a while, Wheatley people had to go to Headington. But it was something of a shock to me to realise that I might well have been an inmate at the workhouse, because I'm old, I'm a spinster, I'm probably illiterate, and I have no family to care for me. By the end of the 18th century, a comprehensive report was published outlining the terrible state of British prisons, not only for offenders, but also for the mentally ill. And while it was secondary to the campaign for the abolition of the slave trade, this plea for prison reform very much aroused the conscience of many reformers. John Fox said, "No man can honestly claim the guidance of God for himself without recognising it in others." This belief that all men are equal in the sight of God shaped Quaker belief. They believed in complete respect for the individual, together with real equality, irrespective of social and economic status. Are these ideals the same that we're striving to achieve today? Now, Quakers at this time in their history numbered industrialists, merchants, and bankers, and with their very wealth, this gave them leverage to high society and government, without which Elizabeth Fry would never have been able to achieve what she did. Now, if I lived at that time and upheld these same values, I doubt if there was little that I could have done. But today, that I am rich through their efforts, there's much that I can do. Dickens very clearly shows us the different attitudes to suffering that we hold today. And at the time of Elizabeth Fry, public hanging was regarded as entertainment. And the hanging of children had only recently stopped. Yet, our thinking of today wasn't achieved overnight. One of the most dreadful experiences of my life was when I was 19, seeing a judge at the Old Bailey put on the black cap and condemn a taxi driver to death for murder. We talked about the horrific conditions in Newgate Prison, which featured in the report calling for penal reform. Now, at this time, when Elizabeth Fry first visited, there were 300 women occupying the space designed for 60. It was very dark and bitterly cold, and as we said, the noise and pandemonium were deafening to such an extent that the governor never ventured there. The smell was appalling, so much so that Elizabeth Fry apparently had difficulty in breathing, and tiny children cowered in the corner, while the others were completely out of control. Now, Elizabeth Fry always concentrated on trying to help the small things, the manageable ones, where she saw the need. She left the politics concerning penal reform to the politicians and to others, and yet was highlighting It was through the small things that she was able to influence those who were in the position to change the law. Through her very gentle, charismatic, yet strangely forceful personality, and her concentrating on the specific, she had immense influence. She never judged nor condemned. Is this a model with which we should identify? There is so much more that should be said about Elizabeth Fry, but I'm just going to mention briefly two of her projects. Elizabeth Fry loved children. She needed to. She was one of 12 herself, and she had 12 children. But she was very good with children. She really related to them. And when she went to Newgate, her first concern was for the children. And as a Quaker, regarding all as her equal, she asked the mothers of these unruly children if she might set up a school for our children, where they would not only learn to read and write, but have instruction in the scriptures. It was reported that the women were so moved that they listened in silence to her reading from St. Matthew, the very passage we heard this morning that Barbara read for us, and the inspiration for Sidney Carter's hymn. My second example concerns the dreadful plight of the women and their children being deported to Australia, often for very minor crimes. Elizabeth Fry and others were deeply concerned about the way these women were travelling, some arriving at the ships in chains, and many dying on the journey. So, always concentrating on the practical, she felt that things would be better for the women on their journey if they had something to do. So every woman was given what must have seemed like an absolute treasure trove, made up of things she had encouraged her many friends to contribute. I think you might be amused at the contents of the bags. One Bible, one Hessian apron, one black stuff ditto, one black cotton cap, one large Hessian bag, one small bag containing a piece of tape, an ounce of pins, 100 needles, 4 balls of white sewing cotton, one ditto black, one ditto red, one ditto blue, 2 balls of black worsted, 24 hanks of coloured thread, 1 cloth with 8 darning needles, 1 small bodkin fastened to it, 2 stay corsets. Laces, 1 thimble, 1 pair of scissors, 1 pair of spectacles when required, 1 comb, 1 small ditto, knife and fork, and a ball of string. Now, this morning we concentrated on Elizabeth Fry as she was the second lady on the Palm Note, but she was but one of many social reformers of the 19th century, trying to challenge attitudes to suffering, initially in this country, and as Tanya said at the beginning, later abroad. Elizabeth's brother, John Gurney, was another wealthy Quaker banker, and he worked closely with William Wilberforce. John Cadbury, also a Quaker, was one of the first to care about the welfare of his employees. William Booth's East End mission became the Salvation Army. Well, Dr. Bernardo and Captain Coram were deeply distressed about the thousands of homeless children wandering the streets of London. And then there were people like Lord Shaftesbury, who fought for these issues in Parliament. 3 years before Elizabeth Fry's death, well, this church was functioning at that point in this building, the Coal Mines Act prevented the employment underground of women and children under 13. And in the year of her death, a Lunacy Act, something for which she had fought, was passed, greatly improving the health to the mentally ill. But passing a law did not mean that reform was immediate. It wasn't until 1875 when the last little boy, the age of Louis, was sent up a chimney. We've been talking about social reform, but we mustn't forget the tremendous progress that was being made at the same time in science, medicine, and engineering, which we haven't had time to think about today, but we should refer briefly to the work of Joseph Bazalgette, I hope I pronounced that correctly, the civil engineer who was struggling at the same time to persuade London to fight cholera by installing a sewage system that we still use today. Until then, half of all children died under the age of 5. Practically every day, something comes through my letterbox asking me to contribute to one charity or another. So often it's easy to put something small in an envelope or some unwanted clothes in a plastic bag and feel you've done your bit. We talk about giving to charity, whereas social reformers, not denying the importance of giving in kind, practiced philanthropy. You don't just give a starving man a fish, you teach him how to fish. And between them, they've helped change our attitudes, our feelings of compassion, whilst setting up education and welfare systems that we have built on today. Our pastoral care team was concerned about lonely people in Wheatley, particularly on a Sunday. So we set up our afternoon teas, which are very successful. But we realise that there are people in Wheatley who haven't the confidence to join us. Why? Do they need a buddy? And one of our projects for the autumn is to think about this. There's so much to do in this relatively small community. But as Elizabeth Fry would have said, we need to make haste slowly. My 80 plus years has seen immense change, ranging from a childhood during wartime in London to the magic of the internet today. My kitchen would be unrecognisable to my skiffy grandmother. And from someone who began teaching before equal pay for women was established, came in, to having a woman prime minister, to be able to live as a spinster an independent life. From the days before antibiotics to the terrific advances in medicine to the NHS, for which I'm personally very grateful. And along with this, we've seen changes in our welfare system, not as much as we would like, but we need to acknowledge that a reform movement is a kind of social movement that aims to make gradual change rather than a rapid or fundamental change. In an obituary of Sidney Carter, he is quoted as writing, "Your holy hearsay is not evidence. Give me the good news in the present tense. So shut the Bible up and show me how the Christ you talk about is living now." I think I can. I was helping at the Citizens Advice Bureau in Oxford, and one lunchtime, judging by her dress and her speech, a middle-aged, middle-class lady came in. She looked ill and sad. I've no idea what her name was, but she came quickly to the point. She wanted facts. She'd been sleeping in her car for the past week, had run out of money, and wanted to know if she was entitled to any benefits, obviously knowing nothing of the system. She didn't want to discuss what had put her in this situation, but I guess it was a family quarrel. But she hadn't eaten for 2 days. And although I found her a cup of coffee and some biscuits, that obviously wasn't enough at that moment in time. I was at a complete loss what to do, when I suddenly thought to phone the Salvation Army in Oxford for advice. Now, you know you can sometimes hear a phone conversation the other end. Well, when I rang, the lady answered, and she called to another, and I could hear this. It's a lady from the cab, and they've got a poor soul there. And then the voice faded. But a few moments later, she was back, and she said, send her down here, me duck, and we will give her her dinner. Note, her dinner, not a dinner. I never saw my lady again, but I knew that where she was going, she would be finding a neighbour in the very sense that Jesus was speaking in St. Matthew's Gospel, and being helped to escape from her prison. So as we said at the beginning, out of bad can come so much good. And now our concept of what it is to be rich has completely changed.